Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what is numeracy or number literacy, and what effect might it have on the history of a nation? Doug Becker explores with a new book on how numbers and numeracy influenced the development of early modern England. And first, to commemorate the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr., we explore the impact of Dr. King and his memory on contemporary issues, including the role of women on the movement and the security of people of color as embodied in the Black Lives Matter movement. What is the meaning of Dr. King's dream today? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. This week, we celebrate the legacy of Martin Luther King. We take time to consider the role he personally played in the civil rights movement, as well as explore the state of civil rights and Black activism in the United States and around the world. We'll analyze the current state of civil rights movements and what Dr. King can teach us about their goals, tactics, and levels of success. Our panel today is David Garrow. He's professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh and former senior research fellow at Cambridge University. And he's the author of Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which won the Pulitzer Prize for biography, among many other publications. Keith Miller is professor of English and affiliate faculty at the Center for the Study of Religion and Conflict at Arizona State University. He's the author of Voice of Deliverance, The Language of Martin Luther King Jr. and Its Sources. Jared Clements is postdoctoral research associate at Princeton University. He's the author of From Freedom Now to Black Lives Matter, Retrieving King and Randolph to Theorize Contemporary White Anti-Racism. And Dewey Clayton, professor of political science at the University of Louisville. He's the author of Black Lives Matter and the Civil Rights Movement, a comparative analysis of two social movements in the United States. Thank you all very much for joining us. David Garrow, we'll start with you. You've written this wonderful biography on Dr. King. So start off, give us a bit of a background. We kind of know the story of King, but what does the sort of common narrative sometimes get wrong or get a little bit mistaken?
The number one thing for people to understand about Dr. King was that he did not want to be in the public role that he ended up in. He was drafted by his Black community colleagues in Montgomery, Alabama, in December of 1955, to lead the new organization that was set up to support the spontaneous Montgomery bus boycott. And King felt, you know, drafted, dragooned even into that role. He was relatively new in town, quite young, an independent figure, not tied up with some of the old rivalries within the Black Montgomery community. And he found being in the public spotlight very stressful. He had a sort of faith experience in early 1956, what the late James Cone and myself and others have called the vision in the kitchen of his parsonage, 309 South Jackson Street in Montgomery, where King felt this sort of crisis of confidence and understood God telling him that this was the role that was required of him, even if he didn't want it, didn't like it. And that deep ambivalence about being a celebrated figure continued right on through the entire balance of his life. It's one of the great ironies of all the FBI wiretapping of King, that one of the most powerful things we see from those wiretaps is King saying to his friends and advisors that he doesn't like all these honors, that he's getting too much credit. So the private King was a very self-effacing man, someone who didn't enjoy getting too much credit, didn't collect, you know, his press clips. You know, when he's named Time Man of the Year for 1963, he says something like, you know, what's one more award, you know, to one of his advisors. And so there's a fundamental humility to King. And he's deeply self-critical throughout all those years. He finds the role very stressful, increasingly stressful, the better known he becomes. And with these awards, I mean, particularly when he receives the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964, he feels that this excess of praise requires him to sacrifice himself even more. And so he has a very consciously self-sacrificial understanding of his role. When his popularity starts to drop, particularly 1967, when he attacks U.S. involvement in the war in Vietnam, he has a very conscious awareness that he's harming his own reputation, but his need to say what he believes to be the truth, even if it's self-harming, always wins out for him. And so that self-sacrificial quality to King's life is, I think, the most important thing for people to grasp.
Right now, particularly this weekend, with the legacy of King, political actors from all across the political spectrum are going to cite King, and often as a way to try to discredit contemporary civil rights movement. Cite King's speech, "I have a dream that we're going to have a race-free, a race-blind society," and then declaring, well, then why are we so focused on race in contemporary politics? First of all, what does King have to say about contemporary politics and race relations today?
You know, I've been doing this, 44 years now, a little more than that, going back to my first book on Selma and the Voting Rights Act. And I must say, as the years go by, the efforts of people to apply Dr. King to the present day get more and more strained. We can't really say what Dr. King would have thought about critical race theory because Derrick Bell and Kim Crenshaw didn't start writing that material until, long after Dr. King was gone. And similarly, in the international context, I mean, so much of what King invested himself in the last 2 years of his life was opposing the military conflict in Southeast Asia. But how we take the Vietnam War and apply that to anything today, I rigorously sort of discipline or censor myself on the, what would Dr. King say about X, say about Y, because it's at best an informed guess. And we're better off to stay within the strictures of what King himself was preaching in the 50s and 60s.
But also, Dewey Clayton, I'll ask this of you, but kind of throw it out there as well. One thing that I feel pretty confident that King would have something to say, and we could probably imagine, has been the gutting of the Voters' Rights Act. And so in many ways, when you think about the civil rights movement, there's this sense frequently in the media that there was an end to it, that we civil rights movement was a 60s thing, maybe a 70s thing. But even the accomplishments in the 60s are now coming under fire. What does that say when thinking about King's legacy, that some of the greatest accomplishments of the civil rights movement are still under attack?
Well, that's true. I think King would be aware of that. I think as a student of history, I think King was very well aware that throughout this nation, particularly in the 20th century, it seemed like every time there was a civil rights push, degree of activism and change was made, there tended to be a backlash from white America. And that happened at the end of the civil rights movement. It's happened at the end of the Black Lives Matter movement as well. And so I think King would clearly be saddened by a lot that's happening now, but not be totally surprised, would not be totally shocked that one of his lieutenants, John Lewis, who fought so valiantly along with so many others to, get the Civil Rights Act, I'm sorry, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 passed and what that involved, and to see how Congress has responded to that and to see how the Supreme Court has responded to that and essentially gutted two major sections of it, Section 5 and Section 2 as well, I think he would be sad and clearly, but I think that he would not be totally shocked by what has happened. I think he was astute enough and smart enough to realize that, America, although we, his I Have a Dream speech in particular, you know, that was an ideal, and King knew that we would not be reaching that ideal anytime soon. So yes, I think he'd be shocked, but I don't think he'd be totally appalled at what is some of the legislation and some of the attitudes that have crept back into the American mainstream.
And Jerry Clemens, I know you've written about white anti-racism, and that phrase itself has numerous contexts when I read this, because at one level you get this kind of a white anti-racism that Dewey Clayton says, well, this was an ideal, this was a dream. But frequently the argument is we've achieved that, or if we're going to achieve it, we have to implement that. So the I Have a Dream speech is being almost anti-civil rights these days. How much of that is white anti-racism framed by a white audience as anti-racism versus allyship with respect to white anti-racism?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's one book that I want to flag just because I think it's a really great text. It's called Prophet of Discontent by Jared Loggins and Andrew Douglas, both political theorists who make this argument that in the book, that one thing that often happens with the way that we think about or remember King is we tend to downplay the extent to which King was very much attuned to questions of political economy and the material foundations of racial justice. And so King, they make the case that he understood that, you know, having access to, you know, the voting booth, the ballot, or other civil rights, while important, ultimately that wasn't enough to ensure the type of equality that was necessary. In other words, like, there needed to actually be some reckoning with the way in which we have organized a society where there's such vast amounts of inequality and wealth accumulation is happening in a way that's not at all equitable. And so I think King would understand that, you know, part of what America, you know, what we have, one thing we have to reckon with America is just the vast amount of poverty and social inequality that continues to exist. And the attack on voting rights is just yet another way to ultimately disempower people through the electoral realm. And so I think King would, of course, not be surprised by what's going on. But if I had to guess, of course, obviously, none of us are interlocutors at this point. So it's just a guess. But I do think that he would really beg us to think bigger about what the American project is, and, you know, how, not only how do Black people sit within that broader project, but how we can look at the condition of many Black Americans as really this kind of harbinger of, like, kind of broader systemic changes that need to be reckoned with. And so, yeah, I don't think you would be at all shocked by what's going on, but I think there's ways that we can kind of look at some of the things that he said about political economy and inequality and glean some things from that.
And Keith Miller, you kind of also reminded us that the civil rights movement has an intersectionality that historians seem to be discovering a bit more over the course of the last, you know, 5-10 years. And I would, as somebody who is himself a memory scholar, would imagine that the main reason for this has been the rise of political power, the rise of the Black women as a part of the civil rights movement. And so I guess the question then is, you know, that linkage, that it's not just a question of race, but an intersectionality question where you introduce gender and class as a part of this as well, as a contemporary political issue. So I guess, how much is this restructuring and this readjustment really about recognizing women played a big role in the civil rights movement, and we need to recover that memory because this is still so very much a contemporary issue about women's rights?
One really interesting part of the civil rights movement, Doug, that most people don't understand, I think, is that there were women in the civil rights movement, such as Polly Murray and Anna Hedgman and Mary King and Casey Hayden, who thought that the civil rights movement was or should be about women's equality and gender equality as much as it was about racial equality. And you really see that with Polly Murray. And they also, Polly Murray, Dorothy Height, they were active long before Rosa Parks, and they were active long after Rosa Parks, long after King's assassination. So their whole idea of the civil rights movement is very different than the national memory, because it's not only about the triple evil, what King called the triple evils, poverty, racism, and war, but it's also about gender equality. So there were people at the time who were arguing for that, and Polly Murray and Anna Hedgman were trying to get a woman as a speaker at the March on Washington, and they got turned down by King and A. Philip Randolph. They said, no, we don't need you. We don't need you. Just go off in the background. And so the idea that the civil rights movement is only about race is contested by people who are involved in the civil rights movement, who are important leaders in the civil rights movement, such as Polly Murray, who was a friend of Eleanor Roosevelt and who later mentored Ruth Bader Ginsburg and had a very long career. And in the 1970s, she was ordained as one of the first female priests in the Episcopal Church. She was a very important pioneer, and she didn't get a biography until about 2015, 2017, something like that, by Rosenberg. So there was this tension going on in the movement, at least, you know, behind the scenes.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the legacy, the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King and the state of the civil rights movement today with our panel, David Garrow of the University of Pittsburgh, Keith Miller of Arizona State University, Jared Clemens of Princeton University, and Dewey Clayton of the University of Louisville. When we think of civil rights today, Dewey Clayton, and you've written about this specifically, we think of Black Lives Matter. And frequently, because Dr. King had advocated for nonviolence and the argument that Black Lives Matter is not as committed to nonviolence, that in some ways that Black Lives Matter doesn't rise up to the image that we have of the civil rights movement. Is there a tension between the tactics of Black Lives Matter, the emphasis of Black Lives Matter, and the civil rights movement under Dr. King?
I don't know if I'd call it tension. I think that looking back and looking at the civil rights movement and looking at Black Lives Matter, it's difficult, in my opinion, to compare the two. Times are different. Times have changed suddenly. If you look at the civil rights movement, there was no social media going on then. There's clearly social media going on now. And even in looking at that, if you look back during the civil rights movement, a lot of what the young people were doing, even some of the things that Dr. King was doing, you know, his father was not in favor of. So when you get a younger generation, you always get, you know, the older generation saying, you know, behave yourself. I will say that the civil rights movement prided itself on respectability politics. And it was about dressing nice and acting nice when they sat in and lunch counters and whatnot. They were well-behaved. They were calm. They were respectful. Black Lives Matter does not necessarily follow that tack. But once again, they're young people. It's a different time. And so one would not expect them to actually be in the same mode. But I will say that they've got a lot of the same goals. And I don't think Black Lives Matter is as violent as a lot of people possibly think that they are. I really don't. I mean, there have been instances throughout various marches and whatnot where there was some violence that occurred, but that occurred back during the civil rights movement. King was often, and others were often, trying to tamp down, you know, some of the violence that was occurring. So I don't think that's necessarily the case here. I see them as basically in a long line of social activism. And I think that basically what they're doing is the same type of enthusiasm and willingness to sort of take things one more step. They're much more confrontational than the civil rights movement had been, but so what? That's good too, you know, and they're achieving many of the goals that they've done. They've brought the issue of social justice and particularly police brutality as it relates to African Americans. They've brought that to the forefront. And look at the results we've gotten. Look, in 2020, we had hundreds of thousands of people, even more than that, protesting all around the world. So I think that's a bad rap in many respects. And I don't really fault them. It's a different movement, it's a newer movement, and obviously some of their tactics, some of their methods are going to be different, but I think they have achieved great results with what they've done, and they've brought this attention to the forefront of people, not just in this country, but all over the world.
And Jerry Clemens, your thoughts as well.
So I think the first thing I'd say is I think there's a way that we tend to reify the Black Lives Matter movement as though there is like this singular kind of kind of organization that's all everyone's kind of pulling in the same direction. And I think that does us a bit of a disservice, one, because very few movements ever operate that way. There's always going to be discord and differences as to how people understand whatever the ultimate aim is of the movement. And so I think one thing that we should reckon with or think about in Black Lives Matter is, again, these different strands of Black Lives Matter. And I think in doing that, you can see that there are some very real radical strands of Black Lives Matter, which are, let's say, anti-capitalist, very much about making sure that it's an intersectional approach to thinking about a movement building. And then there are some that are perhaps a little bit more amenable to the status quo. And I think underscoring that is important. Because then you can see a little bit more, I think, some of the pressure points that I think have become a little bit apparent within the Black Lives Matter movement. And so I would say that also, I think that the distinguishing between what Jane McAvey calls organizing and mobilizing, I think is also important just for thinking about political change. And so she makes the case that what we saw in 2020 was in many respects more of mobilizing. So you're getting people to feel some kind of emotional or this kind of groundswell of emotion in response to an event. Whereas organizing is more of the mundane calling people, following up. It's all in those things to really build towards, you know, a handful of political demands that can be realized. Now, to the point that was made just before, I do think that there are some very real differences now in organizing. We live in a much more, ironically, we're much more connected than we've ever been in so far as like technology is concerned. But I think there's abundant research that shows, but we're also much more alienated and feel isolated and disconnected from one another in ways that we kind of haven't before. So there's this kind of contradiction there that I think we have to really think about. And so bringing this back to King, I think one thing that we could all stand to do a little bit more if we are committed to some of the ideals that he espoused is to really try to have that compassion for other people, irrespective of their racial status or their gender background, and just really think about, you know, how could we build a more inclusive world. So I think that there's a lot that the Black Lives Matter movement can offer us, but there are also some things that we can think about and critique and evaluate going forward as well.
Jared, when you're thinking about this, we focused on social media as a potential variable and the kind of a democratization component of that. I wonder as well, especially since you highlighted some of the anti-capitalist sentiment, at least with some aspects of Black Lives Matter and civil rights, the impact of the Occupy movement and that the Occupy movement has had an influence on civil rights that we sometimes don't recognize.
Yeah, I think that's important to also think about the ways in which movements often overlap. So we can't really think about the civil rights movement without also thinking about the ways in which it overlaps with the labor movement. Like, these things don't just operate in a vacuum. And oftentimes people who were affiliated with one were also affiliated with the other. And so I do think it's important, again, thinking about solidarity and, you know, where are the areas that we can find common ground and agitate towards similar ends. Of course, we're not going to agree on everything, and everyone's going to bring to bear their own, you know, normative understandings of the world that in sometimes can be hard to reconcile, but oftentimes there are those areas of similarity. And so I do think it's important to think about other movements, or even thinking about the Sunrise movement. And so is there a way that we could connect climate change to racial justice? I think there are a number of people who are doing great work that show the racial inequalities that stem from the climate crisis. So I think that there are a number of movements out there that are ripe for this type of cross-pollination, sorry.
David Garrow, when we're describing this, when we look at Black Lives Matter and the frustration sometimes the media has and critics have with a lack of leadership, there's not a Dr. King within the Black Lives Matter movement. Is this always a sort of a historian's, you know, false equivalency that if you associate civil rights movement with Dr. King, if there's no Dr. King, then where's the movement?
There's a long-standing media problem. I mean, going back before Dr. King, of journalists wanting to find a singular Black leader, you know, the greatest change in the U.S., you know, racially the last 50 years is what a, you know, huge increase in the number of Black elected officials there's been. And you look at the Congress today, there is a degree of diversity among Black members of Congress that's not widely or nationally discussed enough. John James of Michigan, for example, new member of the House of Representatives, highly impressive conservative Republican, someone we're going to be hearing from down the road. And don't forget, you know, the most influential Black person in America today is Clarence Thomas, widely misunderstood because folks should read what Thomas himself writes, not what people write about Thomas. Sort of the same principle we advocate with regard to Dr. King. Read King, you know, listen to King. But there is a diversity now in Black America. And with Black Lives Matter, so much as was touched upon earlier, you know, varies, you know, city by city, locale by locale, just as with the Black freedom struggle during the 60s. So I think it's important not to follow the media tendency to want to simplify and force a very diverse world into just one silo.
Keith Miller, now that we're up upon this commemoration, we've just got a few minutes left. And what should be our takeaway of the civil rights movement as we remember Dr. King? What should we remember?
Well, to get back to the discussion of Black Lives Matter, to me, the country has shifted a lot because during the 1950s and 1960s, America was largely culturally Judeo-Christian. So the Southern Civil Rights Movement operated on out of a Judeo-Christian framework, and certainly King did, Fannie Lou Hamer and James Lawson, Fred Shuttlesworth. And today, America, the religions in America are much more diverse. So we have so many Muslims in the country and Hindus and Buddhists, and so many progressives now regard themselves as, quote, spiritual but not religious, or as atheists. So it's much harder to use the Judeo-Christian framework. William Barber is doing that, and he's operating very much in the tradition of the African-American social gospel and King. But it's not just a problem of young people or social media. It's a problem of what kind of premises do you use to make your arguments with a such a diverse population. And I like the work of Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan, who have a secular analysis, a political science analysis, and you're a political scientist, Doug, that tries to figure out which strategies in nonviolent movements work under what circumstances and what countries and which ones don't work. When do you need a boycott? When do you need civil disobedience? And I think that that's refreshing because we're so accustomed to thinking about nonviolence in the context of religion. Gandhi is a Hindu, Cesar Chavez is a Catholic, and so forth. But sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. So I think that using a political science kind of analysis can be very useful and helpful.
I'm so glad you mentioned that work. I teach a course in peace and conflict. I always assign, actually complete, you know, finish the class with that as a way to think about peaceful change. And with that in mind, and we have at least four great sources of scholarship on King that I think you should all pick up and read and learn, teach, and talk about and consider the role that Dr. King has played in American politics and civil rights and in global politics today. Thank you all very much for joining us. Our panel today has been David Garrow. He is professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh and a former senior research fellow at Cambridge University. He's the author of Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which won the Pulitzer Prize for biography. Keith Miller, professor of English and affiliate faculty at the Center for the Study of Religion and Conflict at Arizona State University. He is the author of Voice of Deliverance, The Language of Martin Luther King Jr. and Its Sources. Jared Clements is a postdoctoral research associate at Princeton University. He is the author of From Freedom Now to Black Lives Matter, Retrieving King and Randolph to Theorize Contemporary White Anti-Racism. And Dewey Clayton, professor of political science at the University of Louisville. He's the author of Black Lives Matter and the Civil Rights Movement, a comparative analysis of two social movements. Thank you all very much for joining us.
This discussion was part of a panel recorded in January 2023. To hear the entire discussion, please go to scholarcircle.org. When we come back, how did educating ordinary people, the adoption of Arabic numerals alongside related changes, affect the transformation of early modern England? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How did better understandings of mathematical concepts and the rise in numeracy rates change society, politics, philosophy, and science? And what did it mean for religion? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. What importance should be placed on numeracy and understanding history? Because we often think of literacy rates and the development of literacy in developing a society. But should we be focusing as much on numeracy? In a new book, Jessica Otis explores this question in the historical transformation of early modern England. On today's show, we'll discuss her book and her insights. Jessica Otis is Director of Public Projects at the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media and Assistant Professor of History at George Mason University. And she's the author of a new book, By the Numbers, Numeracy, Religion, and the Quantitative Transformation of Early Modern Europe. Professor Otis, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So my first big sort of broad question is, you're focusing on this development of numeracy, this development of skills within a society, maybe even like new information sorts of technologies. What importance should we place when thinking about history, about the development of skills, communications, the ability to work through problems in the historical development of nations or peoples?
From my point of view, the thing that matters the most when we think about different technologies and the role that they play in society is the opportunities that they make possible for the historical actors that you're studying. It doesn't mean that people will take advantage of those opportunities, right? That's the flip side of the coin. What's available and what people do is not always the same thing. But different technologies open up realms of possibility, and then people take advantage of those, often in really interesting and unexpected ways that open up sort of the possibilities for the historian to understand what they prioritize, what they're interested in. And also, it lets us get around some of our kind of password-looking biases as to what technology should do when we look at how people are experimenting with different technologies and figuring this thing out for the first time.
One of the things I found really fascinating about the book is we tend to view histories as these narratives driven by political figures, driven by events, but you're reminding us that so much of history is really societal, and so much of history is about, as I said, developing technologies, forms of communication. And so therefore, these are important topics that need to be discussed, need to be researched, and frankly are under researched, right?
Yeah, well, especially when it comes to technology, in that the history of technology is often seen as a very specific kind of history. And obviously the history of, shall we call it mental technology, as opposed to physical technology, is another permutation on this. We have a lot more histories of World War I than we have histories of the vacuum cleaner. But frankly, the vacuum cleaner makes a much bigger difference in my daily life than World War I does right now.
Let's get into some of the details here. One of the things I found fascinating was, again, this argument about the development of numeracy, that people just didn't really have, numbers and math weren't really a part of their daily lives. First of all, why was that? And then what changes that makes numbers so much more important?
A lot of it has to do with kind of what people are doing in their daily lives and what technologies they need to accomplish those tasks. We need a lot more numeracy today than people did in late medieval England. And as urbanification continued and commercialization and things like that, numbers became more important in early modern English society. They became more useful. There were more incentives to pick up more advanced numeracy and to do more things with it. But it is worth noting that people were always numerate to one degree or another throughout this time period. And going back centuries and centuries into the past, numeracy is not completely new in early modern England or early modern Europe more broadly. It's a increasing intensification of how numeracy is used on a day-to-day basis. I think one of the more famous examples is the quantification of time. When we start thinking about time, we can talk about, oh, I'll see you in the morning, I'll see you in the afternoon, you know, it's going to be a little while, it's going to take me half a day to do this. Or we can talk about, I'll see you at 9:30. I am going to take 15 minutes to take a break, right? These are both very similar ways of talking, but one is more quantified than the other. And so we see an increasing quantification and an increasing use of numeracy skills to deal with a more quantified world.
No, absolutely. And you know, you think of the importance of even having clocks someplace, as opposed to I get up when the sun comes up, I go to bed when the sun goes down, etc. The idea that we have a clock and our days are so directed by even the concept of hours. Is this when this develops?
Hours have been around for a while. There are medieval bells, church bells that ring the hours. And so at the start of this time period, and indeed through most of the 16th and into the 17th century, most people think of time as an auditory phenomenon. You listen to the church bells. And so the church bells, you know, they don't go every minute. So the most that people can do is say, oh, well, you know, it's been a little while. We're probably halfway between one set of bells and the other. So it's probably, you know, 3:30, but they don't have an exact time. And so that's kind of where they start. Mm-hmm. And then increasingly we see watches, we see clocks in kitchens and households and things that let people be more precise. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they're more accurate. As everybody who has like a old-fashioned watch that has to be manually reset all the time knows, your watch loses time over the months and years. So it's not necessarily accurate, but it's precise. And that mm-hmm. I can pretend I know exactly what time it is, even if it's wrong.
Now let's get into the numbers themselves, because you discuss the importance of the Arabic numeral system. First of all, before we had Arabic numerals, how did the English count?
So before we had Arabic numerals, there were a bunch of symbols that people used to count and to use numbers, some of which still persist today. When I say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I'm using English number words, and that is a perfectly acceptable way to talk about numbers. You can count on with numbers. That's how my 4-year-old niece is currently learning to add. She counts on. She does oral addition. So there's a lot of oral numeracy that is foundational to the way that people then build up numerical knowledge. In terms of written numeracy, it's mostly Roman numerals, which again kind of persist today as a legacy system that's used for prestige in certain contexts. And then in terms of practical arithmetic, what most people actually use is the counting board, which is a form of an abacus. If you're familiar with abacuses, it's a board or a cloth or just lines chalked on the ground that then objects are moved around to add and subtract and multiply. And so that counting board arithmetic is the way that most people do arithmetic in the medieval and the early modern period through the 16th century. The other thing is tally sticks, which are used specifically for tax purposes and accounting. So they're a specialized form of numeracy.
Why then choose Arabic numerals?
So the advantage that Arabic numerals has is that it is a written form of calculation. So if you ever look at Roman numerals, you can't do math with Roman numerals. Very specialized mathematicians have come up with ways that, like, you literally can do math, but no one in their right mind would voluntarily do that for, like, day-to-day transactions. It's kind of an entertaining prestige kind of math, not a practical math. And so if you wanted to do arithmetic, you had to have a counting board. Well, Arabic numerals let you do arithmetic with pen and paper. And that is one of their primary advantages. The sort of corollary to that is that when you do arithmetic with pen and paper, you're making a permanent record, or at least you have the possibility of doing a permanent record with your math. And so Arabic numerals allow this kind of unification of recording and calculation that other systems don't allow. And it's not something that necessarily you have to do, right? People use scratch paper, they use wax tablets. Today we use calculators. But it is a possibility that is enabled by Roman numerals.
Now, one of the reasons why math is required across the curriculum, starting, you know, the very early years of primary education, all the way through to, you know, to higher education, is the perception that math allows us to think abstractly, you know, a bit more, this kind of rationalist approach and thinking abstractly. First of all, how much does the development of numeracy have an impact on just the way in which we think through problems? And so the same reason why we teach math today is the reason why it was so important to develop numeracy in early modern England.
So in early modern textbooks, that's not actually the main incentive that people use when they are promoting numeracy. They argue that it's good for your commercial affairs. And in fact, if you were unable to do basic arithmetic, you could be judged mentally incompetent and have all your property taken away from you and put under kind of like a governorship sort of situation. So for them, the advantage of numeracy was to be able to manage your financial affairs, be independent. They didn't really think about abstract thinking as an advantage of it. But we definitely see in the 16th century, in the 17th century, an increase in the use of numbers and quantification to understand abstract phenomenon. So we see that developing in the early modern period, and it changes the way people really understand and relate to the world. The one that kind of jumps out most obviously, and one that I'm deeply interested in, is the quantification of chance. And this is something that's really interesting because it can be used in both very like practical contexts about, you know, your odds of something bad happening to you or your family, plague epidemics. We see a lot of this. We also see it in insurance, things like that. But you can also see it in just sort of like day to day, the way people interact with the world. What is the chance, the probability of something happening? And so it's really fascinating to see people begin to, I like to call it a pre-probabilistic mentality, and sort of employing this idea that the world can be quantified in this way, even if they don't have a formal math for it yet.
Now, when talking about quantification, talking about math, talking about probability, broadly numeracy, you actually just hinted at this. I want to ask explicitly, numeracy is a necessary condition for the development of capitalism, right? We would not have seen capitalism develop without the development of this type of numeracy.
You can't have a capitalistic society without some sort of numeracy. I don't think that it's necessary to have Arabic numeracy to have capitalism. I'm sure there's medievalists who would have very strong opinions about this and would certainly say more to this than I could. But when you look into like neuroscientific studies about the way the human brain is literally wired to be numerate, we can see the foundations of everything you need to have a capitalist society in that. We as human beings, we create numerical symbols to quantify precisely. And once we have those, we do basic arithmetic with it. And that's really all you need to start getting in kind of on the ground floors of capitalism.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today's topic is the importance of numbers and numeracy in historical developments, and specifically in early modern Europe, the author of a new book on the topic, Jessica Otis of George Mason University. Now, you do talk a lot about the practical implications of numeracy, but there's also some really big metaphysical questions as well. What was the impact of numeracy in understandings of religion, understandings of God, generally speaking?
Yeah, that's the book, right? The big question of the book, because people in early modern England live in an intensely religious society. So everything at the end of the day comes back to God. There are all sorts of people who argue about God's role in giving humankind the ability to calculate. I am always entertained by people who call God the great arithmetician. And there are arguments about different parts of the Bible and the implications for it. Some people say that numeracy is the foundation that God gives humans to have dominion over animal kind. So these are important questions to them. They have a lot of religious implications. And then when you get into the practicalities of people using numbers in their daily lives, religion also is important. So I talk in the book about calendar reform, which is, again, a very quantitative thing, but is driven by the religious need to celebrate different Christian feasts at the right time, which is something, especially in this time period, it's fascinating because people are traveling across the globe. They have an increasing understanding of time changing over space. And so they have huge arguments about when the Sabbath begins, depending on where you are in different parts of the globe and the relativity of time and space. And so these have a lot of deep implications. Going back to plague, again, my chance, right? Because I love studying the quantification of chance. You see people arguing about how God proves his love to humankind through numbers. And so everything that's happening in early modern numeracy implicitly involves religion, even in places where it doesn't explicitly. And in quite a lot of places, they have explicit arguments about it as well. I talk a little bit in the book about censuses, the quantification of people, and there are huge arguments over the legitimacy of conducting censuses based on biblical precedent. And so the Bible is kind of everybody's go-to explain how they should be using numbers and what the different ideas and innovations in numeracy mean.
During this period in early modern Europe, you're getting much more of a sense of science wanting to understand creation, you know, God giving humanity the ability to understand his creation, that you're doing God's work by trying to understand that. Is that also being inspired by and inspiring numeracy? Because without numeracy, you're just simply not able to understand a lot of the natural world around you?
There are definitely people making that argument. It's worth noting that there are people making the counter argument. Just as today, there are people who are like, I don't like math. I'm bad at math. I don't like numbers. There are early modern people saying, I don't like numbers. No, you shouldn't have to do math to be, you know, an elite member of the royal society. We don't like this. And there's a great incident where the Royal Society in Dublin brings a young girl, she's I think 12, into one of their meetings, and she's showing off her mathematical learning. And, you know, there are people saying, oh, you know, this is great. Anyone can learn this. And there are people coming back and saying, no, like, I could never learn this. Don't say it's easy. This is really hard. And this is scary stuff. And they're very insulted at the idea that they ought to be able to learn it and they can't. I think the scientific studies have shown about 10% of the population actually, like from a neurological point of view, has difficulty processing numbers the way that the rest of the population does. And that percentage of the population would have still existed, whether it's a greater or lesser percentage, I couldn't tell you without time travel. But there are always people who have difficulty and would push back against numeracy as being important.
Yeah, by the way, you're mentioning, you know, 10% having difficulty processing numbers. I don't know what the number is, and I don't want to speculate, but there's certainly a percentage of the population has difficulty processing the alphabet as well, you know, processing languages. So what you're describing would be, in the 21st century context, something we might call some form of a learning disability. And so therefore, it makes sense that there would be a percentage of the population that couldn't. But during this period then, if you couldn't, did you face discrimination?
It would depend on the extent of the difficulties you were having. Again, the sort of mental competency trials would ask you to do some basic arithmetic. And if you weren't able to do that, they could say, hey, you're not actually fit to own property. Mm-hmm. But that level of innumeracy is probably rare. And that would be like a severe disability compared to other forms where they might struggle, but still be okay passing these kinds of tests. It's worth mentioning, just because I'm talking about mental competency trials, that they actually differentiate between numeracy and literacy. Literacy is a learned skill. So if you're illiterate, they just assumed you didn't learn to read. Whereas if you're a numerate, they assume that that actually has a fundamental reflection of your mental ability.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Now, this may be an unfair question. If it is, you can tell me. Your research is on modern England, but this development of numeracy as an important component for social change, for social development, how unique is England? Is this something where you could have similar cases, similar books for other Western countries? And then also, is this unique to the West? Because obviously, if you have Arabic numerals, you would imagine that numeracy was probably greater in the Arab world, or, you know, perhaps, say, in the Chinese world.
What I will say, a lot of people look at, oh, you're doing numeracy in 16th and 17th century England. You know, are you talking about the scientific and mathematical exceptionalism of early modern England? And I respond with saying, well, they're exceptional because they get to it really late. The Italians are a couple of centuries ahead of the English on this front, as are the Spanish, because of the influence of the Arabic world. For a while, actually, Arabic numerals are called Toledan numerals because they come to Christian Western Europe through Toledo, through what we would today call Spain. In terms of kind of like global timing of trends, you're probably going to find similar trends happening in France, in the Netherlands, in kind of the far northwestern parts of Europe, whereas places like Italy, which have a greater contact with the Arabic world, are on kind of this trading crossroads with that part of the world. They're getting to these sorts of things much earlier. And the biggest difference is that they are doing all of this before the printing press. So one of the things that really impacts English numeracy is that at the same time that they are starting to adopt Arabic numerals and literacy rates are rising, the printing press makes it possible to mass produce arithmetic textbooks. And I've looked at some of the early arithmetic textbooks that try to teach counting board arithmetic. As you might imagine, having serial pictures of these counting boards with the placement of the objects on them takes up a ton of real estate on a page. So you can have 50 pages to show what you could do in one page with Arabic numerals. And so part of what incentivizes, I think, a lot of the adoption of Arabic numerals is the fact that it fits well in this new printed genre. That's a very big impact in England. I feel comfortable saying that France and the Netherlands, similar impact. The Italians have been at it for a while, though, so they're not surprised. This is old hat to them.
I think what this book indicates broadly is the impact that new information technologies generally have for social change. Are there any insights into the kinds of information technologies that we're seeing here in the 21st century, that looking back in history? And for the record, I don't think history repeats itself. One of the lines I always use in my own class is that I love the Mark Twain line that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. So in any case, what kinds of lessons might we be looking for in the 21st century on the basis of the impact of numeracy on social change, social development in places like early modern England?
A lot of the echoes, I do like it echoes or it rhymes kind of metaphor for history, because it definitely doesn't repeat itself the exact same way as it did before. It's more like a musical reprise, right? Mm. A lot of the echoes that I see, the similarities, the rhymes, have to do with societal disruption and the way that innovation is often coupled with destruction. People who are coming up with these new ways to use technology are doing it without any existing safeguards. And they are often deliberately choosing to disrupt society and trying to be creative, following their own political or personal goals, which is, I would argue, human nature. And so we see a lot of similarities to the way that these technologies can be used and abused, both historical technologies and technologies today. And eventually things will settle down into some sort of accepted use pattern. Probably the generation that's growing up now is a good example of people who've always known computers. And this is just their life. It's not anything disruptive. It's the way the world works. 50 years from now, there will be other technologies that either are just starting today or are to come that will just become normalized. And it's a rough path to get there often, but there's good things as well as the bad when we have technological innovation. To kind of end on a self-serving note, we would not be having this conversation in the era before computers in this same way. And this is something good that comes out of technological innovation.
It's a really fascinating way to look at history. We have a tendency to look at history as these important events, as these leaders, wars, et cetera. But social change in history is so essential. I think this is an essential tool to understanding these developments, and specifically the role that numbers, that math, that numeracy plays in the social development in early modern Europe and implications, I think, for historical developments in other places as well. The title of the book is By the Numbers, Numeracy, Religion, and the Quantitative Transformation of Early Modern England. The author is Jessica Otis. She's the Director of Public Projects at the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media and Assistant Professor of History at George Mason University. Jessica, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.